From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents A Conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for July the 10th, 2016. Hope you all had a great 4th of July holiday weekend last weekend, are enjoying this summertime weather. It's time to grab the Sunday paper, go get that cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to keep your weekend going great. So much going on in the city, and you couldn't ask for more perfect weather. I think yesterday was the most beautiful Saturday I've seen in Chicago in a long time. And all kinds of people downtown, Taste of Chicago wrapping up today. But as Dave said, there's all kinds of festivals going on around the city. Of course, always the tourists that are here, including the one guy who pulled up to me as I was waiting for a cab to ask if he could get a light. never saw that before.
Well,
but you know, maybe that's how it's done elsewhere.
Did you give him a light?
I did.
Okay. All right.
Yes.
Good.
I slipped him a
flashlight. Didn't ask where the water was, or didn't ask where how to get to any landmark like the Art Institute or Willis Tower. I politely tell people that we still refer to it as Sears Tower if they ask directions to get to the Willis Tower.
And, well, I mentioned the other day about the guy who thought the Trump Tower was Sears Tower.
Oh,
and he goes, well, can I walk to Sears Tower? I said, sure, you can walk to Sears Tower. Just follow the river around. I gave directions.
Right.
That was
you didn't
fair.
Tell them you could walk along the river and then tell them to go south onto Wacker. But, yeah, in fact, you are following the river.
Yes, you're following the river. It just happens to be a little lengthy walk. That's all. Or he could rent one of those kayaks or something.
I had someone in the South Loop area getting off the Red Line once, and he came out of the stairs. This was last week. Hey, how do I get to McCormick Place? So,
hello.
But I was stopped once in the same area there, someone saying that, how close are we to Midway Airport?
Yeah, good luck. Yeah. Have a healthy walk with that one.
Yeah.
Although I run into people all the time outside Tribune Tower here wanting to know how long a walk it is to get to Wrigley Field.
Oh, really?
Yes, seriously.
A walk to Wrigley Field.
A walk to Wrigley Field.
Got your work cut out for you there.
Boy, yeah. And speaking of sports, by the way, Sam, I was kind of disappointed that you didn't point out that, you know, here on Friday night, you've got the White Sox get a triple play, their third of the year on Friday, but then they lose a pitcher to the disabled list for slipping on his pitching hand as he's getting out of the dugout for the national anthem.
Yeah, that's Carlos Rodon. He sprained his left wrist walking up the dugout steps.
Yeah. Okay. And he's on the DL for 15 days.
Yeah. I don't know how that happens. I mean, I've gotten hurt in a bunch of different ways.
I bet
that's
you have.
A new one. Walking up the dugout steps, you slip, you fall, and you sprain your pitching arm.
Right. And now, I guess because of the All-Star break, that he's only going to miss one start. So, you know, if there's anything good about getting hurt, although I still don't know how you go back into that locker room after that and explain, you know, I can't pitch anymore.
I don't buy that. Do you buy that, though?
It sounds crazy. It just really, I don't understand it. I don't understand it. And then we've got, you know, the Cubs, with they're having their June swoon in July. I think they've now lost 15 of their last 20 games. And maybe the All-Star break can't come too soon for the Cubs here. So, not, you know, this isn't what I was expecting. Certainly the way the Cubs started off, they couldn't sustain that kind of a record all year. But it's getting concerning, I would say. You know, when you've got Lester having two bad starts in a row, I'm not going to say I'm worried yet because it's the Cubs and you shouldn't expect much anyway, right?
6.5 game lead.
Yeah.
Are you nervous?
Yeah.
You are?
Yeah. I am too.
Well, why not? Why shouldn't we be nervous?
1-9 in their last 10, the Cubs.
Yeah, this is not good. And
especially after the way they started the season.
Well, and again, like I said, there was no way they could sustain that kind of level of play. But certainly, this is, you know, let's root for the All-Star game or something. Take our mind off the Cubs. They play at noon today in Pittsburgh before the break. And I'm not sure who's pitching today, but I'm not sure lately it matters given the way that Lester and Arrieta have been pitching. Kind of not what we signed up for when we became Cub fans. And I'm a longtime Cub fan, too. So let's get back going. I mean, Madden doesn't look worried, but I'm not sure he ever looks worried. That's kind of the zen of Joe Madden that exists. But what can I say? The joys of being a sports fan in Chicago. We had the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team in Chicago yesterday, which didn't get a lot of publicity, but they won 4-0. And we also have the finals of the Euro Soccer Championship today.
Portugal and France.
Right. And I'm sorry to say that Iceland, my favorite team, didn't.
No.
You know? Who could not be for Iceland in a match like that?
Swanee, our announcer, is no longer a part of the Euro Championship. Remember our guy?
He's the one,
he's out.
From last week?
Yes.
Oh, did they pull him because he got a little too...
Well, Iceland lost.
So he was the Iceland announcer.
So he's done.
By
yes.
default, he's okay. gone.
Yes, but I did like the fact when Iceland beat Britain that someone tweeted out that it was the second time that Britain departed the Euro in 1 week. I thought that was very clever.
It's harsh.
It's harsh, but true. Oh, but yeah, what a beautiful day in downtown Chicago. Temperature's supposed to get up into the 80s. No real chance for rain, according to Mike Hammernick out on the WGN Storm Center patio. So get out and enjoy the day, and enjoy it before the humidity comes creeping back in. Dave mentioned that you were out at Taste of Chicago last week, and I said...
It was wonderful.
Well, I said, you know, the only thing about Taste is normally it's in one of the hottest times of the year, and it gets so stifling humid, I can't imagine anybody, you know, eating that kind of stuff. It's like state fair time in Springfield.
Where it can get pretty pretty steamy,
it
I guess.
It can get pretty brutal. And the idea of, you know, then eating warm, deep-fried dough or something like that.
Just, well, again, we're looking at 61 at O'Hare right now, but the humidity is up there. It's 83%. So, you know, we've got calm winds and nice temperatures, but the humidity is creeping up.
Well, and certainly we're looking at 90s for starting the week. And
87 tomorrow. So, yeah, it's going to get warm again.
It's going to get warm, and it's going to get humid again. So take that precaution. And, again, enjoy today while you still can, while you can enjoy that low humidity. Well, Dave's here to keep us up on all the news. Sam's here with the latest sports. Producer Jasmine is here to field your phone calls at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at that number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're also on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is back with us this Sunday to keep the Mighty 720 going. And remember, you can always find our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also find our podcast at iTunes. Just search for my name, Rick Pearson. Coming up, we've got another great show today. After Dave's 7:30 news update, we'll be speaking to my good friend and a good friend of the show, Amanda Vinicky, about the temporary break in the Springfield impasse. Amanda is the State House correspondent for Illinois Public Radio and WUIS-FM in Springfield. Then after the 8 o'clock news update from Dave, we'll be speaking to the state's newest member of the legislature, State Senator Omar Aquino. We'll talk about why anyone would want to go into the legislature, given what we've seen for the last 18 months. And then after the 8:30 news update, we'll be joined by William Daley, the former White House Chief of Staff, U.S. Commerce Secretary, and the son and brother of two Chicago mayors. And we'll talk about the future of the Democratic Party, and can Hillary and Bernie come together? That's all coming up, but right now we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome to the Sunday Spin, 7:18 on this Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson, and it's time for our weekly spin through national politics. And another week, another mass shooting, this time an assassination of Dallas police officers who had been overseeing a peaceful protest involving police-related shooting deaths in Louisiana and Minnesota. We had some of those protests going on here in Chicago yesterday. In Poland, President Obama had this to say.
Today is a wrenching reminder of the sacrifices that they make for us. We also know that when people are armed with powerful weapons, unfortunately, it makes attacks like these more deadly and more tragic. And in the days ahead, we're going to have to consider those realities as well. In the meantime, today, our focus is on the victims and their families. They are heartbroken. The entire city of Dallas is grieving. Police across America, which is a tight-knit family, feels this loss to their core. And we're grieving with them.
Now, we've got Donald Trump already active on Twitter this morning saying, look what is happening to our country under the weak leadership of Obama and people like crooked Hillary Clinton. We are a divided nation, says Donald Trump. Well, the shooting of those five police officers in Dallas brought both candidates for the presidency briefly off the campaign trail on Friday, and it overshadowed one of the biggest developments in the campaign. That was FBI Director James Comey's public statements saying that the agency would not recommend that the U.S. Justice Department file charges against Hillary Clinton over her use of emails and private email servers while serving as Secretary of State. The Republican National Committee created an interesting web video comparing Hillary Clinton's public remarks and those of the FBI's findings.
There is evidence that they were extremely careless in their handling of very sensitive, highly classified information.
I thought it would be easier to carry just one device for my work and for my personal emails instead of two.
Secretary Clinton used several different servers and administrators of those servers during her 4 years at the State Department. She also used numerous mobile devices to send and to read email on that personal domain.
We went through a thorough process to identify all of my work-related emails and deliver them to the State Department, and provided all my emails that could possibly be work-related.
The FBI also discovered several thousand work-related emails that were not among the group of 30,000 emails returned by Secretary Clinton.
I did not email any classified material to anyone on my email.
110 emails in 52 email chains have been determined by the owning agency to contain classified information.
It had numerous safeguards. It was on property guarded by the Secret Service, and there were no security breaches.
We do assess that hostile actors gained access to the private commercial email accounts of people with whom Secretary Clinton was in regular contact from her personal account.
That's the RNC going after Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton canceled a public rally on Friday, but she did make the rounds of some television outlets, showing once again why Friday is why you try to dump the bad news if you're a politician. On CNN, Clinton acknowledged that she's made mistakes.
I am certainly relieved and glad that the investigation has concluded, but I also know how important it is to make sure everybody understands that I would certainly not do that again. That is something that at the time, as even Director Comey said, seemed like a convenience, but it was the wrong choice.
Now, in that CNN interview, Clinton refused to accept the FBI director's characterization that Clinton and her aides were, quote, extremely careless, unquote, in handling classified information. Based on that characterization, Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan said the Director of National Intelligence should deny Clinton clearance to classified information as a presidential candidate.
I think the DNI, Clapper, should deny Hillary Clinton access to classified information during this campaign, given how she so recklessly handled classified information.
Now, it was not a good day for Hillary Clinton, even though no charges would be pressed against her. The FBI's comments were tough. Perhaps for any other candidate facing a tough Republican opponent, they would be devastating. But it wasn't any help to Republican Donald Trump's campaign. Trump gained notoriety for complimenting Saddam Hussein's handling of terrorists.
Saddam Hussein was a bad guy, right? He was a bad guy, really bad guy. But you know what he did well? He killed terrorists. He did that so good. They didn't read him the rights. They didn't talk. They were a terrorist. It was over. Today, Iraq is Harvard for terrorism. You want to be a terrorist, you go to Iraq. It's like Harvard. Okay? So sad.
And Trump's misfire was only compounded when a tweet from Trump used a six-pointed star posted atop a bunch of cash to go after the person he calls Crooked Hillary. But it was immediately blasted as anti-Semitic, and it came from a pro-white supremacist website. Trump, however, doubled down on it.
So one of my guys, who's married to a Jewish woman, this is a very fine person, Dan Scavino, he put out a tweet talking about Crooked Hillary Clinton. And on the tweet was a star. It's a star. Like a star. CNN started this dialogue going, it's the Star of David. And because it's the Star of David, Donald Trump has racist tendencies. These people are sick, folks. I'm telling you, they're sick. Actually, they're the ones with the bad tendencies when they can think that way. They're the one. Then they said, remember what I said, but there's money around the stars. You know, they took the star down. I said, too bad. You should have left it up. I would have rather defended it. Just leave it up and say, no, that's not a star, David. That's just a star.
That's Donald Trump. Meanwhile, President Obama announced that 8,400 U.S. troops will remain in Afghanistan after his term has ended. That's an increase of the 5,400 troop level that Obama had scheduled.
Instead of going down to 5,500 troops by the end of this year, the United States will maintain approximately 8,400 troops in Afghanistan into next year through the end of my administration. The narrow missions assigned to our forces will not change. They remain focused on supporting Afghan forces and going after terrorists. But maintaining our forces at this specific level, based on our assessment of the security conditions and the strength of Afghan forces, will allow us to continue to provide tailored support to help Afghan forces continue to improve.
Now, turning to Illinois politics, Trump met with Republican senators and House members, and according to the Washington Post, he blasted Illinois' Republican Senator Mark Kirk as a loser. Now, Kirk has taken back his pledge to support Trump as the party's nominee for president, and of course, he's in a close battle to keep his seat against Democratic Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth. Well, in an interview last week with Steve Cochran, Kirk had some unusual things to say about how he would secure support from Latinos.
They're interesting. In the race between me and Duckworth, I have challenged her to a debate in Spanish that we hopefully will do on Telemundo. I thought, in her case, as a Democrat, she would try to put it forward the case that she can represent Latinos better without speaking a word of Spanish. For me, I went to school in Mexico and have a great affection for Mexican culture and the language there. I would say that I'm a much better representative, and maybe that's why latest polling showed me leading among Latinos.
That's Senator Mark Kirk. Also last week, it marked the passing of Abner Mikva, truly a public servant of his time. Democratic Senator Dick Durbin offered this tribute to Mikva on the floor of the U.S. Senate.
Abner Mikva was a friend, and in addition to that, was an extraordinary individual. His record of public service is unmatched. I can't think of anyone off the top of my head who did so many distinguished things in both the legislative branch of our federal government in the House of Representatives, serving on the U.S. Circuit Court for the District of Columbia in the judicial branch, and as general counsel to President William Clinton in the White House in the executive branch. You see, Abner Mikva combined them all.
That's Senator Dick Durbin's tribute to the late Abner Mikva. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on The Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to Amanda Vinicky, my good friend who's the State House correspondent for Illinois Public Radio and WUIS-FM in Springfield. After the 8 o'clock news, we'll have new State Senator Omar Aquino from the 2nd Senate District on the west and northwest side. And then we'll close out the show with Bill Daley, former White House Chief of Staff, former U.S. Commerce Secretary, and a supporter of that independent MAP amendment movement.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
312-981-7200 is our phone number. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin, and I didn't make much of a big deal about it last week, I did mention that it was Sam Panayotovich's dad's birthday, and there was just a sighting of his dad here in the lobby at Tribune Tower, who kindly brought me a birthday cake. And thank you so much, Sam, and happy 70th birthday to you. And he's now headed up to the newsroom to share some goodies with those folks up there as well. It's been, because it was the July 3rd, July 4th weekend, and I didn't want to really get into the intricacies of the temporary break in the Springfield impasse, I thought we'd do some catching up with that kind of after celebrating last weekend. And we finally did have a break, and joining me now on the phone is my good friend, the State House correspondent for Illinois Public Radio and WUIS-FM in Springfield, Amanda Vinicky. Amanda, thank you for joining me.
Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. I want to play this cut of Governor Rauner speaking outside the governor's office following this six-month stopgap budget legislation that was passed. And I want everybody to listen carefully to how he interprets it.
Let's be clear. This is just a small step in the process of making Illinois strong and healthy and vibrant. This is a small step in the right direction. This is not a budget. This is not a balanced budget. This is not a solution to our long-term challenges. This is a bridge to reform.
Okay, bridge to reform being the key word, although if you remember some of the epic Senate debates, is it really a bridge to nowhere?
Exactly, or maybe imagine a bridge and then it just stops at the halfway point. And so what do you do? You jump off, go back? I'm not quite sure it's a bridge to reform. And further, of course, that I think the governor by that means his turnaround agenda, an agenda that wasn't included in the budget, of course, and that's why Democrats say they were able to back it, and that's why it passed. So, I'm not sure that we can agree with that characterization, but I think he had to put some sort of a positive spin on that just because, frankly, Illinois needed something to happen. So I think that's why so many people are cheering for this measure. And yet it really, as I noted, kind of that bridge that goes halfway, it doesn't quite actually lead the state to anywhere or resolve so many of the longstanding budget issues.
And it's not even a balanced six-month budget.
No, it's not. Because you've got to remember, it's not just the budget itself. So you hear also Governor Rauner going around saying this is better than the $7 billion out-of-balance budget that Democrats tried to pass, which is true because it doesn't cover a full year of spending. But it both doesn't include all of the money that Illinois is still paying out because of court order, consent decree, and continuing appropriations. So there's like this huge chunk of money that isn't part of it. So I think that there's that to keep in mind. And frankly, as I noted, it also is a budget that says that it's supposed to take Illinois through December, but there are questions about whether that will even be allowed to happen or whether the state will run out of money before that point in time. And then you also have that it's covering, in cases, spending for the fiscal year that ended in June, also supposedly, again, the first 6 months of this fiscal year. And yet, even with that, many of the social service agencies, or for example, you look at higher education, they're not getting money for, you know, the full. If they were
getting, they're not getting their, they're not getting made whole.
They're not getting their share. No, they're not getting made whole at all. And yet, as you noted, it overspends. So that's where I think there's room for some hefty criticism of the budget, because again, it just doesn't resolve any of the matters that lie at the heart of why Illinois has an unbalanced budget and why, frankly, the governor said he was going to come into office and do something about it.
Well, you know, when the governor said that, when he called it a bridge to reform, he was, in his remarks, indicated that both the Democratic House Speaker Michael Madigan and Democratic Senate President John Cullerton have said that they wouldn't take up his so-called turnaround agenda until after the election, and that he still felt like that was something that they would take up after the election. And that's why I kind of question whether it's really a bridge to nowhere.
Right. Well, I mean, a couple of things here. First of all, I can't quite imagine the Democratic leaders saying that to him. However, I do think that the notion is probably true, and that's not just for Democrats, but for Republicans as well. Leading into an election is just not the time that a lot of controversial measures like he's been asking for a while now, we're going to finally come to a head. That's not the time that you do it. But afterward, he's really holding out hope that some of the however many millions of dollars he's going to pour into the race will make a difference. And he seems to believe that that will, you know, turn the tide, that there will be enough Republicans that it will diminish Madigan's power. I don't know, and if that will happen, of course, the election is a ways away, but that's at least what he's saying. There's really, however, very few scenarios where you could take away Democratic supermajorities, even, or at very least, it would be difficult for Democratic majorities to be done away with. And so I think that this is the recognition of divided government. And they were able to, in this, achieve some form of, you know, kind of compromise. And there will be a couple of issues that do need to come to a head. So you look at, for example, pensions. And in order for Chicago public schools to get some of its money, that some form of what evidently the governor deems appropriate and acceptable in terms of reducing the state's costs when it comes to public employee pensions, that's got to pass. That's part of this bargain there. So I guess we will see something on his turnaround agenda, presumably go forward after the election.
But you did have the governor leading up to this, you had the governor saying and truly going around the state saying, not one extra dollar for Chicago public schools. No bailout for Chicago public schools. And now you have these supporters who have, Republicans who have passed with Democrats a full year funding plan for the state's public schools. You now find these Republicans now having to explain, oh no, I didn't vote for a bailout for Chicago public schools.
Right. This isn't a bailout. They all need T-shirts that say that when they go knocking door to door to ask voters for support. I mean, it is something that I think a lot of people notice, because you had the governor in his budget address, or perhaps it was the State of the State, but regardless, very early this year, the governor in one of his big speeches talking about education funding, and that was one of really the big holdups with the budget, particularly because Democrats in the Senate were calling for a change in the formula and how Illinois decides, okay, we've got this much money and how it's going to be divvied up to various school districts because they believe that it's very unfair. So there was this big push for change, and the governor during this address said, you know, what has been a problem with it in the past is this. It's been so divisive and putting one district over the other. And then, even as he had decried the division here, kind of fomented it, as you noted, on this tour, and really trying to almost pit Chicago versus downstate. And then you're right, Rick. I think that a lot of people do see this as a quote-unquote bailout. But then the defenders, Republicans, say in saying, no, you don't call it that, that isn't true, is, again, that it does come along with the overall pension, what advocates of that would call relief, which I think public employees would say, hey, no, that's pension theft. But
That's why I never used the word reform.
Exactly. He can use it, but I'm not going to use that word reform either. That comes along with the connotation that it's a good thing. But regardless, it comes along with this pension change. And so I think that's part of it. And then you do have other schools. It's not just CPS that is getting advantage. But talking about an out-of-balance budget, I mean, schools get a heck of a lot more money. I think the governor was in a tough position because he portrayed himself as the education governor wanting to put more money into schools. And Democrats looked at that and said, oh, yeah, you think that that's enough money for schools? No. We want to top that. And all well and good, I think most people would say we want our schools to be great and you want children to be educated, and that is important for the future and the economy. But at this point in time, Illinois, of course, doesn't have hundreds of millions of dollars extra lying around. So it's even more pressure for some either bigger cuts elsewhere or a tax increase down the road.
We're speaking with Amanda Vinicky. She's the State House correspondent for Illinois Public Radio, WUIS-FM Springfield, and also a recent birthday girl. Happy birthday, Amanda.
Aww.
We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. 7:48 on this Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson, and this is your Sunday Spin. And I'm speaking with Amanda Vinicky. She's the State House correspondent at Illinois Public Radio, WUIS-FM Springfield. And we're kind of talking about some of the multiple dimensions of the temporary six-month resolution of the Springfield impasse. And, you know, Amanda, a lot of people have asked me, you know, what actually led to kind of the breaking of the logjam. And part of me thinks it's that, you know, we've seen this game of chicken going on for 18 months on both sides because both sides thought they were winning. And I have to wonder that, you know, as it became apparent that it was a very real threat that schools might not open, the additional monetary issues with Chicago Public Schools, that the risk kind of outweighed the reward.
Mm-hmm. And kind of mutually assured opposite. It was going to be mutually assured destruction, but to what end? And so instead they finally came together. And I do think the election pressure played into that. It's the question that I'm always asked is, you know, how can they not get it together? And if that were me and I was a legislator, the governor or whatever, and I didn't do my job like that, you better believe I was fired. And of course, that's what elections are for. And there are not enough districts that are competitive. I think where you would see the true turnover, just not enough people running for office, and not enough money being poured into it compared to what both the speaker and, of course, the governor, even more so, are going to put into these campaigns and races. But nonetheless, when you are having, I think, it's pressure from voters who then put the pressure on their rank-and-file legislators who then put the pressure on high and say, we can't do this any longer. And so, like you said, I mean, just the thought of schools not opening on time, what were they going to do when they need to be worried about their election? And then instead spending the entire summer in Springfield fighting over what the opening of schools. I mean, Illinois had already really become a laughing stock. This is a historic impasse. The longest, you talk to the folks at NCSL, that's the National Conference of State Legislators, and they, you know, measure, and they can't say the longest that any state has gone in throughout history without a budget, but, well, kind of the longest in their recorded history, dating back to the 30s or so, that any state has gone. So it just got to the point of, I think, untenable, embarrassing. Another point of pressure, legislators hadn't been paid. They did get checks this week, but beyond that, they had gone at the bottom of this big pile of checks that Illinois doesn't have money to actually pay on time, and I think that that was some pressure. So there are various elements, but really, Rick, I think when it comes down to it, it's as you said, just they both thought they were winning. It turned out that all sides were losing, and so they came to an agreement, and you cannot and should not, I guess, given how harmful the impasse has been, not find that reason to, I don't want to say celebrate because that's too strong, but good. You know, finally, these guys and one woman got together and were able to reach a compromise. But you also can't give any sort of true toast or dance about, all right, it's done. They came to an agreement, because they really just left most of the stuff and kind of hid it under the tablecloth.
And it's a half agreement, and it's part of the job that they're supposed to do. We've got a call from Ron. Ron, welcome, as always, to the Sunday Spin.
Yes. Good morning, Rick. Amanda, certainly that decision probably was politically popular, but I think the elected officials were still negligent in their duty. Where is the revenue coming? If the state is already $9 billion in the hole and they have not come up with any revenue for this 6 months to cover these programs. So that's my question. Where is the revenue? Thank you.
And that's the big unknown question.
Darn good question.
Well, and certainly it was highly unlikely that any action on raising taxes or raising revenue, the euphemism, was going to happen before the November election. And a couple of reasons there is, one, of course, no politician wants to raise taxes before an election. Two, Democrats were not going to raise taxes alone. They were going to require some Republican votes to do that. And so the fear of voter retribution existed, really, I think, on both sides.
Exactly. And I think the governor has long said he won't go along with any sort of tax increase unless he gets his way on the quote-unquote turnaround agenda. Those are those either business reforms, term limits. If that passed, maybe he'd be all right with it, something along along those lines. And, of course, that hasn't happened. And so that's where really, as I keep on saying, because I think you can't diminish that, the true heart of the argument hasn't gone anywhere. And even though, again, there was an agreement to do something about pensions, what that will look like or what that will be, that hasn't been decided. And further,
plus you have the legality of of whatever they do with that as well.
Right, sir. Past sentence, but if the courts knock it out, what does that do to the states, to this question overall? You can't rely on it for years to come. So there's so much unresolved, and really, and then of course the revenue. So you look at it, and like I said, it's a good question in terms of where is the revenue. I guess in a sense you could think of this as a minor positive for the budget, and that every day that the impasse went on, it was costing the state more and more and more, but not really there, because Illinois is continuing to run up a monster deficit, which means we continue to have to pay interest on these bills that were overdue and paying, and that continues to put a strain on all of the vendors that choose to do business in this state. And you did have the credit ratings agencies weigh in, and really, particularly when it comes to universities, the very day that this budget passed, you saw a majority of the state's public universities get a credit downgrade because the agency said, hey, yeah, great, you get some money, but it's like a meager percentage of what you would typically get in, it's supposed to cover a 2 years' time. There's no guarantee, people say, that it's a partial budget that carries the state through to December, but clearly what we've seen, there's no telling that any action will happen then. So how long really is this money going to have to last? There's just a whole host of issues ahead.
One thing I think that's interesting in kind of the aftermath of the days of when everybody, you know, was able to get out of Springfield were some of the comments by the governor in which he said that, you know, perhaps the biggest mistake he made was in the way he did his messaging. And in some respects, even taking shots at the media, because the media didn't really understand or relay what he was saying.
I haven't spoken with a lot of people to get their reaction, but I am guessing that there will be many Illinois residents that might be offended by that notion that, you know, at this time where so much pain has been caused, that was the regret. But I don't know. I think the media, it's difficult in a sense too, because what he's been asking for when it comes to the turnaround agenda, they're all complicated issues. You know, what is the prevailing wage? So to get into that at every story and to really explain that, to explain what is at stake, because I think it's not just a couple or this handful of changes, but if you take it a step further, this is something, for example, in diminishing the power of unions, that has consequences, not obviously just for the unions themselves, but that has long-term political consequences, as would, let's say, you know, term limits or changing how the state draws its district lines. It has the potential to really diminish Democrats' power going forward well into the future. So, I mean, there's so much. But thanks, Rauner. I guess we'll do better, Governor. It's the media. I think we've tried our hardest. Not that the media is always deserving of its own pat on the back. But it was an interesting answer to a question of biggest regret. And I think really shows, again, that he's digging in his heels, if that's the regret of the situation.
Interesting answer. I would agree with you 100%. Amanda Vinicky, State House correspondent from Illinois Public Radio, WUIS-FM, Springfield. Thanks so much for joining me this morning.
Beautiful day. Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, newly inaugurated State Senator Omar Aquino.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue. And I'm joined by the newest member of the Illinois General Assembly, State Senator Omar Aquino from the 2nd Senate District, which is west, a little bit northwest.
Northwest side in Chicago mainly, but a portion of Elmwood Park as well. We go as far.
Mayor Saviano over there.
Yeah, skip. We go as far west as 74th Court and as far east as Racine Street. So it's a pretty pretty nice stretch on the northwest side there.
And you were sworn in on Friday or on July 1st?
July 1st, yeah. So I didn't get to actually go down to Springfield and take any of those votes, even though I got some calls of saying, we're going to vote out every incumbent. I was like, well, I wasn't in there for that one. You can blame me on some others.
I'm not on those roll calls yet.
Yeah, not yet. Not
yet. Yes. And Senator Aquino replaced former State Senator Willie Delgado, who had been in the General Assembly in the Senate since 2006.
That's correct. He's actually the first Latino to ever serve in both chambers.
And now you are the youngest Latino ever to serve in the Illinois General Assembly, and we were making fun of his age off the air as because I'm such a crabby old man, I've been told. You know, when you look at what has, and obviously you've been keeping an eye on it, you were, you know, you are the presumptive senator because you have no opposition in November. Mm-hmm. But so obviously you've been watching this game. I mean, and you've been in the game. Mm-hmm. I mean, you worked for Tammy Duckworth, outreach coordinator. You know the political game. But when you even still, you've been outside it enough that it's got to be as frustrating and maddening to the rest of us, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, it's one of those things that we were speaking about it earlier. I got in July 1st. I didn't choose that. It ended up sort of just happening that the Senator Delgado earlier in the month in June decided that, hey, this is going to be my last month. And early on, it did not look like anything was going to happen, that there wasn't going to be a stopgap budget, that more than anything, people were saying to me, well, if you get in during the summer, be prepared to go down in Springfield this summer. And, you know,
Enjoy Springfield in the summertime.
Yeah. Yes. Which I hear is lovely this time of the year. So
it is now. Wait till state fair time. That's okay. When it really steams up down there.
It's what's frustrating is that, you know, I've continued to sort of knock on doors and talk to my neighbors, and it's frustrating because they're frustrated. You know, they're tired of the lack of action that is happening down in Springfield. And so they want, no matter it, people are in Illinois, I say in general, I don't think they care if it's Democrat or Republican right now. They want us to come together and move things forward.
When I spoke with Amanda Vinicky earlier, I think that frankly was the key to why something happened, was because it moved beyond the issue of people caring about the partisanship as much as just the dysfunction.
No, absolutely. I was listening earlier. I think Amanda's spot on when she says that, you know, it really came from pressure from rank and file to, you know, to the leadership to say, hey, let's get something done. But that came from those rank and file members being in their district and having people either at their doors or giving them a call and email and saying, hey, I want something to get done. I don't care how you get it done. Do something. That's what, you know, that's your job. And so, you know, as a representative, as a senator, everyone in our districts are boss. So we got to listen to our boss. If not, hey, the democratic process, as much as we get hired in when we're elected, we can get fired as well, as, you know, many of elected officials have seen that.
So what do you as a newcomer bring to the table?
Well, I think, you know, I bring a fresh perspective. I bring independence. You know, I'm going to be working hard to represent the people that, you know, live in the second district that are my neighbors. And so, you know, I'm not one that has been in there generation over generation. It's like, no, I know best for, you know, my community. It's no, I got to listen to my community and know what, you know, vote for my neighbors. And so what I'm hoping to bring in is just a sort of an outside perspective. I understand how things get done in Springfield. I was down there. I worked in the House for some time. But, you know, I'm looking forward to working with other, you know, in a bipartisan and bicameral way. I'm looking forward to also work with someone pretty young named Will Gazzardi, who's on the north side. Not one of my state reps, but just south of me. And so looking forward to, you know, working with some like-minded people. And just try to move some things, some good legislation forward.
Everybody that comes in stresses how they want to work bipartisanly. But as we've seen over the decades, that issue of bipartisanship, and we've seen it nationally, and now it's come to Springfield, where the partisanship takes over, and that compromise is a dirty word, that compromise is viewed by some as surrendering your principles. And I mean, you worked in staff down in Springfield, so you've seen that firsthand too. About, you know, where do we break the impasse? Does it have to be in a crisis mode, such as what we just have gone through with, you know, things like the threat of schools not opening? You talk about constituents being angry. I mean, if schools hadn't opened, you know, everybody was going to wear the jacket for that.
Absolutely, but you know, one of the things that, you know, when we talked about, you know, how the problems with our schools right now, I'm actually, as someone from Chicago, a product of CPS, I'm actually glad that it was the entire state that was sort of suffering and not just Chicago, because we have a governor who at every point was saying, no more money to Chicago, it's a bailout, as if he didn't represent the people of Chicago, that he represented Central and Southern Illinois, everywhere but Chicago. And so, you know, it's good that something, you know, the stopgap budget, it's great that something happened. However, it's not something that we should be saying, oh, this is victory. Oh, we finally
done it. I don't think anybody's singing Kumbaya.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. but I think to have some optimism, I think it shows that, yeah, when push comes to shove, we can actually work together and get something done. I'm looking forward to trying to work with a lot of, you know, my colleagues on the other side of the aisle. But the man that I'm not necessarily holding my breath that he wants to work with me is our governor. And I say that because of every single thing that he has done since being in office, or the lack of, you know, taking action. You know, he's really stuck on sort of this political agenda, this turnaround business agenda, austerity agenda that he wants to set, you know, push down in Illinois, when I would argue that some members in his own, you know, caucus probably doesn't want that. I know people in the state of Illinois don't want it. And I know people in my district don't. So, you know, if we can move things forward and try to pass a budget and not say, hey, everything that I sign has to come with these so-called reforms, we might be able to get something done.
Well, indeed, the absence of the turnaround agenda was one reason that the stopgap budget was done.
Absolutely.
But as the governor says, he terms that as a bridge to, quote, reform.
What's funny is that we finally get a place where the governor says, all right, I'll put my agenda to the side and I'll sign something. You know, let's negotiate and get to a compromise. And we get there. And the first thing, instead of saying, hey, you know what, if I actually shelve this turnaround agenda for some time, we might actually get, you know, push some legislation, you know, be able to pass something. Instead, he says, well, the turnaround agenda is never going to die in Illinois. You know, it's like, if you just saw where if you don't use that as a criteria, we actually can come up and, you know, the General Assembly can come to some compromise. Kill the idea. It's turnaround agenda is a failure. Crane's business is, you know, who were big supporters of his during his primary run and general election run, called it a failure, called since he's been in office, they said it's been an entire failure, his tenureship. Governor Egger, who's a Republican, had said the turnaround agenda is the reason why we're in this, the impasse that we're in right now. So, you know, it's not just, you know, myself as a Democrat saying, you know, trying to attack our Republican governor. It's just saying this is the reality of the situation. It's not, it's a big problem of why nothing's getting done in Springfield.
We're speaking with State Senator Omar Aquino, State Senator from the 2nd District, Democrat, City of Chicago, with a little slice of Skip Saviano's territory in Elmwood Park. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. +717 on this Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson, and this is your Sunday Spin. I'm here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue. I'm joined by State Senator Omar Aquino, the newest member of the Illinois General Assembly. And we're talking about what he sees ahead for Springfield. You were touching on the turnaround agenda as kind of the key to what had been the impasse. But is there any part of the governor's agenda that you could support?
I don't know about support, but I would say that I would have an open ear towards independent maps. I mean, there's going to be a judicial ruling later this month. I think the 21st, the judge just said this past Thursday, on possibly getting on a ballot for a referendum. The only concern with, you know, taking the maps out of making the maps out of a legislator's hands is that as a Latino, as a person, a minority representing a minority majority district, I want to make sure that our state reflects the, you know, the population that we have, so that we have districts that represent, you know, communities of color. And so I know that there's a lot of groups, though, like the Latino Policy Forum, which I'm looking forward to speaking to, that support that. And I just sort of want to, you know, so I'm open to sort of listening towards that. But when you're talking about,
you don't have a comfort level for it.
Not yet. But I would say, you know, attacks on working class families through, like, trying to take away, creating this state into a right to work state. That's not happening on my watch. I wouldn't vote to take someone's collective bargaining rights away. I think if you work any job in this country, it should be your right to come together with your colleagues and just fairly negotiate wages and benefits. I think that should be a right. And so
what about workers' comp?
You know, in terms of reforms that are going to be supporting the worker, that if someone gets injured on their job, they're going to get their benefits and pay from it. So these are things that, you know, they're going to come up for negotiation. I'm not going to say that I'm not going to listen at all, but, you know, independent maps are one of those things that, I'll consider, but, we'll have to see.
All right. We've got a call from Mike. Mike, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question for the assemblyman. What is it that you're really opposed to in Ronner's proposals for reform? Because so far all I've heard is that from all of the Democrats, or the majority, I should say, that we need more money, we want to spend more money, we can't support this cutback, we can't support that cutback. But you're just putting the state further and further in debt. And amongst the other states, this is probably the worst-run state ever, okay, of all of them. When are you guys going to wake up and say it's not a matter of getting things done? Because in the eyes of Democrats, it's give me more money so I can spend it here, spend it there, to ensure that I get reelected.
All right, Mike, thank you very much for your question. Senator, I mean, let's face it, there's that belief out there that sure. It's about spending the money.
No, well, I'll say that, Mike, thanks for the call, thanks for the question. Let me make something very clear. No Democrat, Republican, no one, I don't think, has ever raised their hands and said, I want to pay more taxes. And as a legislator saying, like, we want to make sure that my neighbors and our people are paying more. I think that the argument is that we are living in a reality where it's just basic arithmetic. Unfortunately, because of the mismanagement that's happened in Springfield over decades, we are in a situation where we just can't cut our way out of the problem that we're in. I mean, we've seen that with the lack of budget with the current governor. I mean, he, I think, even realizes that because every single proposal for a budget that he's had hasn't been balanced. He's proposed budgets that were out of balance because we need more revenue. The argument that I make is, and this is what I ran on, is that I think we need progressive forms of revenue. We need to completely change the way we generate revenue in this state. It's our state is one of the most regressively taxed states, where that means that those that cannot afford to pay more are actually are put on the burden to pay a lot more in terms of percentage-wise from their income. And those that can afford aren't asked to pay as much. So corporations and the wealthy, I'm just asking that they pay their fair share. So if that's through a millionaire's tax, if that's through a progressive income tax, and I do realize that we need to change the Constitution in order to do that, because at least for our income tax, it's on a flat rate by the Constitution, but I'm willing to put that in a referendum to say, hey, let the people of Illinois decide if we want to change our Constitution so that we can have a progressive income tax. And I think what I'm saying is unfortunately, we're in a situation we do need revenue. I'm asking who are we asking to get that revenue from? And I just say it needs to be in a fair and balanced way. And right now, it's definitely not.
What about as far as expanded sales tax? That's been something that's been bandied about. Do you have any thoughts on that as a revenue source?
I mean, the thing is, we've done that, like in the county, we've expanded sales tax.
Well, they've increased it, but expanding it to services, for example, yeah. That kind of thing.
I think that's just more of a sort of a regressive, form of taxation. I think you have to really change the way we tax, especially on the income, because that's the reason why our property taxes are so high. It's because the way that we don't tax enough on our income in this state, we have to tax elsewhere. And so that's what, I mean, we've seen that when we increased the income tax just a few years ago from 3.75 or whatever.
3.75
to 5% temporarily. It actually sort of helped us out, it was a benefit. We were actually,
paying bills is what paying pensions is what we were doing.
Yeah, I don't want to say it was getting us out of the situation we're in. It wasn't, but it was at least getting us to a better place. And so when it came back down, we saw where, you know, we just don't have the money. We don't have enough revenue to provide for a lot of things that are needed. You know, I think MAP grants are needed. You know, it allows someone who wants to get a better education and a better job and become, you know, a productive person in our state, provides them an opportunity to go to, you know, get to go to college. And, you know, if we're not giving, you know, things out like that and saying like, oh, well, it depends where you come from and your family and your neighborhood that you get to choose to go to college or not. That's unfair and not right.
Well, that's the way the grade schools are, though. Grade and high schools in many respects.
No, absolutely. And that's why I'm fully supportive of my colleagues, Andy Menard's bill to change the way that we are allocating monies to school. I think the funding formula definitely needs to change in the state.
But that's a very complicated fraught with all kinds of peril about the winners and losers argument, unless you have the revenue to support something that, you know, you can at least kind of hold school districts that might lose harmless for a period of time.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to how we're generating revenue.
But it goes back to revenue.
Yeah, it goes back to, the argument always goes back to revenue. And so I don't think there can be anyone that can, you know, in the General Assembly, even our governor, I don't think there's anyone can say that we can cut our way out of the situation that our state's in. Unfortunately, because of mismanagement over decades, we are in a situation that we need revenue. But it's, how do we get that revenue? How are we changing it to make it in a more fair and equitable way? Right now, it's not, because trust me, Mike, I'm sure if you live in Chicago, you're not too excited about the prospects of another increase in your property tax. And I'm saying that there's proposals out there, you know, a progressive income tax can possibly bring down your property taxes if we could push towards something like that.
I want to ask you about pensions and public employee pensions.
Sure.
Because, you know, obviously, you know, that's a big chunk of the money that the state spends. It's money that can't be spent elsewhere. Not to say that, you know, as the courts have ruled that, you know, the employees or public employees are entitled to the pension rights of when they were first hired. And so you have, as Amanda talked about, kind of the conditional idea of giving Chicago additional state money to help cover its pension nut, the only city that property taxpayers pay that huge percentage for their pensions. Yeah. But that's conditional on some kind of, quote, pension reform, unquote, getting done in Springfield.
You know, it's one of those things that I understand that there's the governor wants reforms of the pensions. However, our Supreme Court has already said that, you know, this is a contract. This is something that has to be, you know, people are, as you said, entitled to these because that's what was promised them when they, you know, when they took their employment. And so that's for some, that is their only income when they retire. And to say that we're going to cut that in some way, you know, I would say if there's any reforms that are going to come up, I just want to make sure that labor is there to negotiate those things. That CTU, IFT, especially with the teachers' pensions, that if they come to some sort of compromise with the governor, then absolutely, then I would support that, but only if it, you know, involves labor in the negotiations. The other thing is that in terms of, I wanted to mention something that you and Amanda were talking about, that the governor says that, you know, giving money to Chicago is a bailout, but we never talk about how Chicago pays for everyone else's pension in the state, or teachers' pension throughout the state. You know, Chicago gets to you know, the foot of that bill, yet the state doesn't come and help, you know, Chicago ever. So to say that, oh, this time, you know, the state is going to give some money towards, you know, Chicago's teachers' pensions, but with this condition, well, we don't have a condition in giving to everyone else in the state, though. So I think that's a farce.
It's part of the joys of living in the city by the lake.
Yeah.
State Senator Omar Aquino, the newest member of the Illinois General Assembly, thank you so much for joining me this
morning.
Thank you. We'll be back with more right after this. Coming up on the Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking with Bill Daley, former White House Chief of Staff, former U.S. Commerce Secretary, the son and brother of two former Chicago mayors. And also he is a supporter of that independent map amendment drive that Senator Aquino mentioned as well. That's ahead.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning, 8:35 on this beautiful Sunday morning in downtown Chicago. Just a quick personal note, my brother Steve and his wife, their family foundation, they put on this charitable event which benefits Angel Flight Central. And if you're not familiar with Angel Flight Central, they provide flights, they're private pilots from throughout the country, but here in the Midwest is where Steve is part of this, that for healthcare emergencies or humanitarian reasons, they provide flights to, organ donation, that kind of emergency surgeries, those kinds of things. Well, they're putting on their Wings and Wedges golf event out at, of course, it would be at Prairie Landing Golf Club, which is out by the DuPage Airport. And that's coming up on Friday, September 23rd. And if you'd like to participate or sponsor or get any more information about this event, it's a valuable service, you can go to www.angelflightcentral.org. That's angelflightcentral, one word, .org. And your help would be greatly appreciated. Well, joining me now on the phone is William Daley, the former White House Chief of Staff, former U.S. Commerce Secretary, and as I pointed out, too, a supporter of the Independent Map Amendment. Bill, thank you very much for getting up with me this morning.
Sure, Rick. Nice to join you and your listeners.
I know at the end of June you had expressed some concern about Bernie Sanders and the fact that the Vermont senator was not moving actively to endorse Hillary Clinton. And now it seems like, well, we've had the platform committee meetings in Orlando. It sounds like on Tuesday that the two of them will be together and there will be a formal endorsement. But yet there were some pretty significant concessions made by Hillary Clinton during the platform committee. But does the stuff that goes on in the platform committee really matter?
Well, yeah, the truth historically, platforms aren't really the nucleus of a campaign in a general election, or neither are they the sort of the blueprint of governing necessarily. They are an expression of the party's position. And, you know, we've ended the primary process, which is a party function. I know Bernie Sanders did quite well. You know, you get big crowds and a lot of enthusiasm, and for his genuineness in many of his positions, he did, though, come in second. He did lose by almost 4 million votes, and Hillary Clinton won rather comfortably in the states that mean and are extremely important come the general election. So I have felt that that as then Senator Clinton, when Barack Obama beat her in the primaries and they ended in the first week of June, she immediately endorsed them, had no conditions, as far as party reform or positions of policy, and basically supported him 1,000% and encouraged her supporters, and as proven in the general election, then the vast, vast, vast majority of those who supported Hillary Clinton moved over and supported Barack Obama. I think this last month or so of sort of Sanders negotiating, demanding, not yet endorsing, we're only 10 days or 2 weeks away from the convention and waiting till then, from a senator who did generate a lot of excitement but never been a Democrat, never run as a Democrat. He's run as a socialist, which is fine, and Socialist Party has a long history in parts of the world and in the United States, but not one that's risen to the national level, and as proven by his deciding to run as a Democrat, not a socialist, was it wasn't going to become a meaningful party and express meaningful change. So I'm happy to see he's on his way to hopefully endorsing. I hope it will be an unqualified, enthusiastic endorsement and telling his supporters they owe it to the country to get behind her because of the seriousness of this election when you have her versus Donald Trump.
Well, you also pointed out, and as you said, you know, it's a primaries are a party function. It's not a general election function.
Right. And each state determines that, as you know, Rick. They determine the rules under which the party apparatus. It's not a national primary, so if one state wants to have a caucus or an open primary like we have in Illinois where you can just show up on election day and say, I'm a Democrat, other states like New York, you have to register as a Democrat before a couple of weeks before the election. That's totally appropriate. But to somehow imply that one's good, one's evil, and we ought to have one dictated by Washington rule for states. Is that the way the system works?
Well, you've also defended the issue of superdelegates, which, of course, is something that Sanders first assailed, then said, well, I'm going to try to woo the superdelegates over to me.
Yeah, superdelegates. Look at the Republican Party right now, I assume, wish they had a lot more superdelegates who are people who are year-round active in the party or run for office, and by virtue of their being a congressperson or a senator or a House member or a senator or governor or DNC, they spend a lot of time on behalf of the Democratic Party in issues fighting for them. And this is not exactly like they're getting some, you know, winning the Powerball. They get the chance to go to a convention without having to run as a slated delegate because that, now they don't have to decide before the elections in their states or until the very end, but that's their choice because they're party leaders and they bring a certain judgment that balances an emotional movement that may be going on, or like you have in the Republican Party, somebody who gets 30% basically in the vast majority of primaries, and ends up, because it's a 12 or 13 person field, as their nominee. And there's a serious question: does he really represent the Republican Party, whatever that is? And as I say, I think it's totally appropriate that those people who year in and year out give to the party should have the opportunity to be there because they're leaders of the party. And I don't think there's anything evil about it. And they can decide to endorse Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton or whoever when they want. It may be that the vast majority of those superdelegates who are members of the House and Senate who have worked with Bernie Sanders, very few, if any, of them wanted to endorse him. And that in and of itself is a commentary for those who worked with him most over the years.
You know, at the outset, we talked about the platform. There were a couple of things that Hillary Clinton acceded to from the request of Bernie Sanders supporters. But one was the fact of doing the Pacific trade deal. And, you know, there was a bit of an outcry that a proposal to urge Congress not to approve that trade pact, even though that's something that the Obama administration is actively pursuing. And Hillary Clinton supported it and then turned around and said she was against it.
Yeah, and I think that's a good example. I think for the party to have gone on record at Bernie Sanders' request to be against what the president has said is one of, in his opinion, the most important economic votes and agreements for the future of America would be a repudiation of the president. Now, there's differences in the Democratic Party as there is in the Republican Party around the issue of trade. But to reject the president would have been unprecedented for the Democratic Party to do. So I think the party was right not to in their platform, call on Congress to reject the president's one of his main economic agreements. But it's a debate, and it will continue, obviously, whoever wins, because both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have come out against this agreement. Trump, a much broader way against trade and globalization. But the truth of the matter is so much of what is discussed around trade and job loss, which is legitimate, is a result of technology and globalization and the fact that much of the world now is opened to ideas and technology and travel, and that wasn't 30 years ago. And we've got to deal with it, and it's not easy. It's very difficult.
Well, obviously, you know, with your role in NAFTA and that kind of, and the issue of trade, and you know, what I frankly, you pretty much answer the question is, you know, what has really changed that has made trade so evil in the minds of average people?
Well, to happen to have, you've had, to a large degree, stagnant wages for years. You've had lots of companies, take the Oreo cookie plant, you know, on the south side of Chicago that's moving 600 jobs to Mexico to make the same cookies they're making there, but a lot less wages. And so, obviously, the people affected by that see that as an unfair situation for them. Now, you know, that you can, on the one hand, say to the company, which I would, this is outrageous. You know, you've been here for umpteen years. There's got to be a way to make this work better. But it's because of the economic difficulty we've had over the last number of years and stagnant wages, especially for the middle class. Again, much of it, job changes by virtue of technology and jobs that were done by, whether it was a receptionist at an office, are now done by voicemail or iPhone or whatever new technologies that's out there to replace lots of jobs. And that's the dynamism of our economy. You can't just stop that. It's a tough issue. Emotional. I do believe that there is no turning back on globalization, opening of the world. I think we have to be tougher on our trade. NAFTA, at the time, 25 years ago, in my opinion, was a good agreement and was something that I think President Clinton felt strongly was part of trying to bring the economy back, and it did come back. It was along with that a budget deal that had a tax increase that the Republicans fought. And then the economy ended up creating the business community, and the growth of the economy created 21 million new jobs in that period. So you know, again, 25 years ago, NAFTA, which lots of people point to as the evil agreement, I think it was, no doubt there were job losses, but I think overall it was good for the economy at the time. But that's 25 years, and I think President Obama very much saw the difficulties in the trade agreement, and much of what he got in the Trans-Pacific Partnership was a result of looking at the last 25 years of trade agreements and saying we could do better. And on top of that, there is an important piece of our foreign policy in our allies in Asia, whether it's Korea, Japan, so many countries, Philippines, to have them understand that they should continue to look and deal with the United States, because so many of them have a question of whether we're going to continue vis-a-vis the growth of China and their economy to be an important part of the economy and relationships in Asia.
We're speaking with William Daley, former White House Chief of Staff and former U.S. Commerce Secretary. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. @8:49 on this Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio at Tribune Tower, and I'm speaking on the phone to William Daley, former White House Chief of Staff and former U.S. Commerce Secretary. You know, Bill, I wanted to ask you, just while we're on the subject of trade, what your thoughts might be on the whole issue of Brexit.
Well, look, I was shocked by the vote. I think it will have enormous ramifications politically for the U.S. potentially over the next number of years. Our European relationship, our relationship with England has been strong. Obviously, there's been peace in Europe since the European Union came about. And so I think it has a possibility, putting economics aside, of having a serious impact on the sort of U.S.-world relationship, depending on what happens going forward. I think economically it may be very difficult for England, but the devil's in the details of the actual agreement of Brexit, and that's yet to be negotiated, obviously.
You know, the Trump people like to say, well, that's a reflection of kind of this new nationalism that's in the public's mind.
That there's no question that there's a sense of nationalism or populism, whatever you want to call it, around the world, including in China and Russia and other places. That's not exactly always pretty and always a positive thing, because we are interconnected as a world. we should be very proud, and we are, of the U.S. and as Americans, what we do around the world in trying to help and alleviate poverty and keep security and protect our citizens and other parts of the world. So that may be true, but that's not all a positive thing. The nativism that's going on in many parts of the world, fueled by a lot of far right, as you see in Europe, in different countries. Austria almost elected a far right, the first one in Europe president. They have to redo the election. So that may be the case, but it isn't exactly a positive thing all the way around.
Going back to where we kind of started this conversation, so we assume that Sanders will endorse Hillary Clinton on Tuesday, but does that bring those Sanders voters to Hillary Clinton?
Well, I sure hope Bernie Sanders, that's why, as I mentioned earlier, Rick, I hope he's unequivocal, because I had the opportunity, as you may remember, to chair Al Gore's campaign in 2000 against George Bush.
Who can forget that?
Yeah, right. Who can forget the 5 months, 5 weeks? And many of my friends in the progressive, almost socialist who believed in Ralph Nader didn't think it would matter that Ralph Nader was running. And Ralph Nader was very much tougher on Al Gore and attacking Al Gore than he was George Bush during that period. And lo and behold, he got 97,000 votes in Florida. Al Gore lost Florida by 500 votes. George Bush was president of the United States. And if anyone thinks their vote didn't matter in that election, that fundamentally changed the world, that election, and the course of the U.S. After 2000, in many ways, our economy, our standing in the world, our position, the cost of the wars we've been in now for years. So I hope, that's why I cannot wait to hear his endorsement, and hopefully an unequivocal and encouragement. It's not up to Hillary Clinton to go and get the Sanders voters to be for her. Bernie Sanders has to participate in that, and he has to be out there saying, this is important. If you believe in what I believed in, you must be for Hillary Clinton and help her win and stop Donald Trump.
How damaging was the FBI and James Comey's findings?
Look, I think it was very damaging, no question about it. There was, obviously, she didn't, in the FBI's mind, commit a criminal offense that was recommended, therefore, to be prosecuted. But, as she has acknowledged, she made a terrible mistake. It was stupid, and it just compounded itself. I think there, though, most people who believe that somehow that reflects on Hillary Clinton's character and her capacity to be president probably is already against her. I think the people in the middle, again, you have to look at the candidates on the ballot and say one of these is, the odds are one of the two and not the Libertarian is going to be president. So who am I going to be for? To take a pass and walk away, as I said, a lot of people in 2000 thought it didn't matter. And lo and behold, it mattered greatly.
Well, you know, when we talk about Bernie Sanders supporters and how you're looking for that kind of emphatic push by him to go to Hillary, and then we just had a release of a poll, I can't remember who did it, which actually showed that the Libertarian candidate was slightly leading Donald Trump among younger voters.
Well, look, I think younger voters who are looking to the future, it's pretty hard to envision them leaning towards Donald Trump, because much of what he talks about is about recreating a world that I don't think the younger people would like to see, whether it's economically, whether it's militarily around the world, how we look at ourselves, how we view our fellow citizens, view people around the world. So I could see, obviously looking at the polling data, as you do, Rick, that Hillary Clinton's got a problem with younger people, and because people don't trust her. I've known her. I've worked with her. I think she's extremely competent. I think she is one of those candidates that has a difficult time campaigning versus governing. I think she'd be a very good president. And there's one thing that's pretty obvious this last week in our country. We need to lower the rhetoric, get working together again. I have the honor of working with the presidency, and we're a dysfunctional Congress. Many people just saying, no, don't do anything with this president. I think Hillary Clinton, in her days as senator and even as first lady and as secretary of state, will aggressively work with Republicans if they're willing to work to solve some of these problems, because we cannot keep this crazy politics going of hate and questioning everyone's motivations and their. I may disagree with a lot of people on politics, but they're not evil, and we shouldn't demean people in this rhetoric that's out there. And quite frankly, Donald Trump fuels it in many ways, as do many populist nativists do. That's dangerous for our form of democracy, extremely dangerous. And we're seeing much of that rhetoric, not just from him, but from lots of people on all sides, causing a tremendous tragedies around this country. And I think it's about time everybody just take a deep breath and stop and think before they talk.
There is some advice from Bill Daley, former White House Chief of Staff and former U.S. Commerce Secretary. Bill, thank you so much for getting up and joining me this morning on the Sunday Spin.
Have a good day to you and your listeners. Thanks.
We'll be back with more right after this. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I'd like to thank my guests, Amanda Vinicky, the State House correspondent for Illinois Public Radio, WUIS-FM in Springfield, newly inaugurated State Senator Omar Aquino from the West and Northwest side, and William Daley, the former White House Chief of Staff and former Commerce Secretary. And most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening and hope you all get to enjoy this beautiful, beautiful Sunday.